This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's been a week now since a collapse trapped six men in the Crandall Canyon coal mine near Huntington, Utah. So far, there's no sign that they're still alive, but officials at the Crandall Canyon mine refuse to give up hope. Emergency workers started to drill a third hole through the rubble in an attempt to locate the men. Mining is difficult, dirty, and too often dangerous work. And except for moments like these, we scarcely give it a thought when we switch on the air conditioner. Writer Jean Marie Laskus accompanied a coal mining crew in Cadiz, Ohio, to try to find out more about this job and about the lives of miners for an article in GQ magazine titled Underworld. So if you've worked underground, what's it like? What's the best and worst part of the job? What do you know about this job that we don't and need to know? If you have questions also about the life and the job, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, or you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation is what I meant to say. Later in the program, what's in a name? Would a candidate named Fred smell as sweet? And a prose poem by Thomas Edison that you've got to hear to believe. But first, underground. Jean Marie Laskus is a columnist for the Washington Post magazine, a professor in the creative writing program at the University of Pittsburgh. She joins us now from radio station WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Nice to have you on the program today.
Great to be here.
And I wonder, the men that you went underground with in Ohio, is there an overarching miners' culture? Does it make a difference if they're in Ohio or Kentucky or West Virginia or Utah?
Oh, one thing I really learned is a coal miner is really a coal miner. And the brotherhood is really worldwide. They're all under the ground somewhere, and think of each other as all part of the same brotherhood, I really think.
Now, obviously, before you went underground with these men, you'd probably done a little bit of research and thought you had some idea of what you were getting into. What was the biggest surprise?
The biggest surprise? Well, I think going into it, we all sort of have this notion of what it is to be in a coal mine. It's very romantic. You know, we have a lot of country music songs about, you know, the sort of sadness and drudgery of that work. And I thought that there was going to be some connection to the earth, maybe, that these people had, or the connection to something that kept them going in. Something romantic. I wanted the romance, you know. And in fact, what I found was that it was much more about a very, very, very good-paying job for an awful lot of people, and that it goes on all the time, not just when we hear about an accident occurring. You know, it's the only time we sort of even think about coal mining. I really thought it was sort of like, you know, didn't even go on that much anymore. I thought it was rather quaint, actually.
Yeah, there's a quote that you use in the beginning of your piece, a newscaster, I think, during one of the disasters a couple of years ago, saying, why do we need coal anyway?
Right. And that was I think in a large way that is our mindset. We think of coal as something that used to happen or used to be a part of us. But in fact, it's, you know, every time we flip on a light switch, we're burning a lump of coal. We all burn 20 pounds of it a day. It's 50% of our electricity. I didn't know that. I don't think most people realize how dependent we are on coal in this country.
And you were looking for romance, some attachment to the job or some notion of the job. And if there was romance with the earth, it was the romance with the earth of the farm above ground. Well, you found a lot of people, a lot of the men you were with, were mining coal to make money to support a farm.
Exactly. And I think that's the culture, certainly on the eastern side of the United States. And it's been that way for well over a century. A lot of the reasons why a lot of our small farms are still intact are because of the coal fields in West Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Ohio. People are mining to afford those farms. You can't afford to be a farmer anymore. And if you're attached, a small-time farmer, you know, a small, you know,
family farm.
We're
not talking the King Ranch here, yeah.
Right, we're talking beef cattle, you know, 50 head of beef cattle, because it's what you love, it's because it's what your father did or your grandfather did, and it's where you belong in the world. You know, you can't afford to stay there anymore, but if you're in the coal mines, you can. It pays very well. So a lot of all the guys I was with mined coal in order to afford something else, whether it was their farms or one of my guys, I call them now, they're my friends, you know, was funding his boxing career. They all had something to afford that they were passionate about, and so they went into the mines.
And is this young man's work?
This is largely young man's work, but actually yes, it is now, because, you know, there was a time of about 20 years where we weren't burning so much coal. So we've missed a whole generation of coal miners. So right now you've either got old guys, meaning, you know, the old guys are maybe 50, that'd be very old, or young guys. We don't have a lot of guys in the middle who even know how to mine coal right now. And that's a bit of a crisis in employment for them. But I did have one coal miner friend who, his name is Pap, and he was the old man of the mine. He was 62. That's really old in a coal mine.
And 62 and doing one of the more dangerous jobs. And you kept trying to ask him, why are you still doing this?
Yes, that was my question for all of them, but certainly Pap. Because at 62, you know, a lot of what happens is you work your career in a coal mine, and you work that career in order to get a job above ground. You know, maybe become a mechanic above ground. Put your time in underground to get above ground where it's safe. That was the trajectory for many of them, but not Pap. He wanted to stay down there, and he did. He had the worst job, roof bolting. Like, he's the guy responsible for the roof not caving in, driving, slamming these bolts up for 10 hours a day. And I kept saying, Pap, why are you still down here? Why are you still here? He couldn't answer that question. It took me a really long time of just observing his life to finally get it. And what I finally understood of his life was that he was a worker. It was how he defined himself since he was a little boy in Catholic school. He was the strong boy. He was the one who went out and cleaned up the cemetery. He was the one who just worked. And that's his ethic. You work until you're not able to anymore. You work until either you're killed, or maybe your leg gets smashed, you know, or, you know, the roof caves in like it did on his father. That's when you stop. You don't stop until you're not capable anymore.
Yeah, he said his father was covered up, 2 days after he signed on to become a miner?
2 days after his, yeah.
After Pap was signed on, and his father was then covered up.
Covered up in the mine. Didn't die, but got sort of, you know, severely disabled. And but Pap's attitude was, you know, it was the best thing that ever happened to him, because he had been a drinker, and he stopped drinking after that, so it really kind of saved his life, he said. There's like a real fatalistic attitude, I think, among many of the guys I talked to, which was, you know, you're doing this terribly dangerous work, and you're going to do it until something bad happens, but something bad's going to happen anyway in your life, so you may as well just, you know, make a good living to support your family.
If you've worked underground, if you know people who do, if your family member does, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Jean Marie Laskus, there was one of the men, one of the guys, who said, you know, he started out writing about him and saying he was determined not to become the fourth generation miner in his family.
Yes, that was Billy. He was the crew chief. He was a really, really wonderful kind of a chivalric man. He talked a lot about the fact that he desperately wanted anything but coal mining. His great-grandfather had come here from Czechoslovakia, what's now Czechoslovakia, to work in the mines, died in the mines. His grandfather died in the mines. His father started working at age 12 in the mines, got black lung, died in the mines. Billy was determined to break this chain, and went to college to become a nurse, wanted to be part of the air-conditioned world, as he called it. You know, just you know, have an easier, physically easier life. And hated school, hated being in college, just didn't feel that he belonged, and finally, you know, realized his heart belonged, or his life belonged on the farm that he was raised on. And he again, you know, had to find a way to stay on the farm, and went back into the mines finally, and he's okay. You know, he's okay with it.
There's this great passage in your piece where he went through what you went through, what everybody who goes down there even once goes through, which is, can I take it?
Well, that certainly was my experience, and I really was just a, you know, compared to these guys, really just a tourist. I mean, I spent over a period of several months going in and out of the mine, but the first thing they say to you is, you know, you're going to find out right away when you go under if you can take it or not, if you can handle it mentally, if you can handle the sort of, you know, the claustrophobic conditions and just the notion of it, just the notion that you're 500 feet under the ground in a tiny little tunnel headed into the earth for another, 5 miles into another tunnel, encased in an area where you can't even stand up. It's only 5 feet tall in this mine I was in. So you're hunched over the whole time. There's a lot to deal with just on that level.
Jean Marie Laskus's story in GQ is titled Underground. It's about coal miners. Let's see if we get some callers on the line. This is Dawn, and Dawn is with us from Florida.
Hi, Dawn.
Yeah.
Dawn, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say I'm a kind of a different type of individual. I was underground for 9 years, and I really enjoyed it, and somehow I got into carpet cleaning, but then coal was phasing out when I got in. Steel mills were shutting down. They didn't need the coal. And sometimes I think a little bit too much emphasis is put on, like out in Utah. I know, it's sad when someone gets hurt, but accidents happen in all fields of work. And I would honestly say, being a carpet cleaner now for 25 years, that my life is actually a bit more hazardous on the highway going from house to house than it was when I was in the coal mine. But I understand how some fields, that's real dangerous work, but I've never, ever put it as extremely dangerous as a lot of people do, personally. But that's me,
Jean Laskus.
I would like to be back there if I could, but I don't much care for the cold weather. Neither does my wife.
I understand. It gets cold down in the mine, too. But Jean Laskus, I think statistically, this is very dangerous work.
Statistically.
One of my jobs is when, in the backup construction, when it caved in, I had to secure that area and then pull down some stuff and get up there and secure it and bolt it up and then clean up the mess. But never did I, and I've ran for my life 2 or 3 times there.
Oh, but I'm glad it wasn't dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I have to sometimes swerve for cars too, And yet I still jump in this car and go every day without blinking an eye.
All right, Don, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about life in coal mines this hour, a life underground. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. What do you know about life underground that we need to know? This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, and this is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Flip a switch, run your vacuum, use your refrigerator. Half the electricity in the United States is generated by coal. This hour, we're talking about what it takes to get that coal with Jean Marie Laskus, who spent some time with a coal mining crew in Ohio and profiled the lives of those miners for an article in GQ magazine titled Underworld. Of course, we want to hear from you, particularly if this is your world. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org, or you can check out our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And, Jean, I know that one of the things that surprised you about going down into the mine was the color when you got to the bottom.
Yeah, that's really bizarre. It's white. The elevator door opens up, and everything is white. That apparently surprises an awful lot of people when they first go into a coal mine. But they spread rock dust on every exposed surface of coal, which is a white kind of powder, to make it so that it's not explosive. It has to be rock dusted in order to, I guess, make it so it doesn't explode.
Mm-hmm.
So you go through the mine, and it's crusty white, almost like, it looked more like undersea, crusty white, yeah.
But that first moment you thought, they just done this for morale purposes or something?
I did. I was so naive. I thought it was like a joke, maybe, or like, just make you feel better when you go into the mine. I figured you hit the black part a little bit like later on when you got deeper in.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's all white. It's except for the face where they're extracting the coal at that at that moment.
And the mine itself is only as tall as the seam of coal. You don't want to dig underneath and get rock, or dig over it and get rock. So if the seam is 18 inches, you're working on your stomach.
Yes, and there was a lot of talk, there was a lot of bravado around what was the smallest seam you ever worked in among the guys, 30 inches, 36 inches working on your stomach. And that took me a while to get to, because I thought, well, what's the problem? Why would they have these working conditions where you are hunched over all day long, like literally, getting your neck crooked? And I kept saying, why don't they just make this thing bigger? What is the problem? But it isn't a problem. It's the coal seam is, an act of nature. That's how wide the ribbon of coal is. It's a soft product, and above it and below it a rock, and you mine above it and you're making a mess, or making it so that it, is not structurally sound, and mine below it and you're making a bigger mess of water and all sorts of things. So you're just taking out the coal seam, so that's that's defined by the seam.
Hmm. Let's get Dustin on the line. Dustin's with us from Wyoming.
Thank you for taking my call, Neil.
Sure.
I'm much like the gentleman you were discussing earlier. I'm fourth-generation oil field trash. And I tried to escape it for years. I went to college and was at an office job for about 10 years out in California. And just around here in Wyoming, the energy industry is where the money is. We have coal, we have the oil field. And I know a lot of people who are in the more hazardous work, such as the oil field and the railroad, which is higher pay because it's a little more dangerous. And these same people turn around at the end of their career and go ahead and, you know, and no disrespect to these people because I know they're working hard, but it seems redundant to me for these people to turn around at the end of their career and sue their employer or sue the, you know, whatever it is, for their health problems when they knew all along that was part of the deal, despite they were getting more pay. Did you find a lot of that amongst the coal miners you talked to?
Well, for many, black lung comes as an unpleasant surprise. That wasn't part of the package they signed up for. But anyway, Jean-Marie Laskus, go ahead.
I'll tell you, I found so little whining among these men about the conditions. I was really quite surprised by that. I thought I would hear a lot of, you know, oh, they need to give us better safety conditions. They need to, you know, work on the methane levels down here or something like this, or what's happening to me in my lungs and all of that. I heard so very little of that. It was more, I mean, these guys at this company, I'm sure it goes company by company, union by union, but in this particular mine I was in, they felt that their employer treated them well and had very little complaints about the health conditions, and almost naively so. Like, I wanted to say, you know, look what you're breathing every day. They didn't even wear masks. That surprised me.
Well, it's very admirable, and I appreciate all the work they do. Let them know that, okay?
All right. Thanks, Dustin.
Thank you.
Interesting. This was a non-union mine that you were in. The high pay, the safety, the conditions, they owe a lot to the mine unions that were formed in this country. You don't quote the men that you were working with in any sense talking about politics or unions.
No, and the little bit of union talk that we did was very much whispered, and they did not want to talk about it because some of them had been union men, some of them were friends with union men. It was very I found that to be a source of tension, whether or not you were in a union mine or not. The feeling was that a lot of these mines aren't going to be profitable if they have to work with the unions. So that's the only reason they have as good a job as they have, because this mine is open and they love their employer and they're not going to mess with it. That was the sensibility around that. And I couldn't get into any union mines. The unions wanted nothing to do with me. The large coal companies wouldn't even answer my calls to get into their mines. It's I never was part of an industry that wanted so little attention. I mean, so little attention.
And we keep talking about the guys on your crew, and the particular crew you were covering. Were all men? Were there any women miners?
There are a few. There was one at the mine where I worked. Very few. It's almost like a, a peacock or something in a mine. It's very unusual.
Let's get Stephanie on the line. Stephanie's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to first comment and say thank you so much for bringing this subject to light. It really needs a lot of attention. And also, when you were in the mine, did the miners ever have any safety concerns, equipment failures, things that weren't being fixed? My uncle was in an accident in West Virginia in a coal mine and was killed due to a faulty panic bar on the instrument he was working on. And I'll take my comment after the air.
Okay, Stephanie, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
The safety concerns with the crew I was with were always present. Every one of them had a terrible story of either someone getting killed or someone, you know, seriously, you know, crushed and made it out alive. But, I mean, serious injury, not just, you know, a little broken finger. So it was always a concern, and there were every day practically a new, you know, something new that was they were coming up with to make it a better environment. You know, you hear a lot in the news about how such and such a mine had so many safety violations. How could it have still been operating? Every single one of them has a gazillion safety violations. The inspectors are down there every single day. State inspectors go through those mines, checking. It's just so complicated, and so much can go wrong, and so many things can are unknown. You know, you're in the earth. It's moving. It's not a. It's not like being in a factory where you kind of have a predictable sort of set of circumstances. It's nature. You know, you're in the middle of the earth.
And a constant, you report, a constant topic of conversation is what the miners refer to as the top. This is good top. This is bad top.
That's always the first thing that it seemed that they would look at. Because the top is basically the roof over your head, which is barely, it's really more over your shoulder because it's only 5 feet tall there. And you know, it's some places it's good and some places it's bad. It depends on the rock formation above it. It depends on whether you're, you know, in limestone or shale or what other geological forces around you. But it's, you know, it's crumbling. It's certainly crumbling a lot and caving in. I mean, there were cave-ins when I was there. It was common.
Were you in one?
No, but I heard it. It was not far from us, and it was like loud thunder, and they kind of go, everybody looks at each other like, okay, who's going to go look? And someone goes to look and sees the damage.
I've been on naval vessels and whatnot in various times, and the people who show outsiders around take this sort of well, you know, sure, they want to make sure you're safe, but they're not very necessarily happy that somebody who doesn't necessarily know what they're doing is down there.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I had a lot of that. I was kind of like the annoying tourist that wouldn't stop coming. They really, on one hand, yes, that was the case, but on the other hand, they really did want to show. They do feel misunderstood. They feel their work is really misunderstood. They feel that people don't know they're there. And I think they were really happy to, like, let people know. We're under here, and we're taking this coal out for you, people. You know, you think we're all a bunch of stupid rednecks. And we're here doing this hard work so you can have electricity, so you can have air conditioning. And don't forget us. There was a little bit of that.
Now, let's get Tom on the line. Tom's with us from Green Bay in California.
Hi. Thanks, Neil. I wanted to pick up just on a short little thing. I've been in South Africa in mining, both in coal mining and in gold mining, not as a worker, but as an equipment supplier. And it's interesting that it's not cold down there. It gets very warm as deeper down. I've been down as far as 6,000 feet in a gold mine, and you can hardly breathe. It's 120 degrees and very, very difficult to breathe down there. That was just a comment I wanted to make.
But the mine you were in, Gene, was considerably nowhere near as deep as that, but chilly, 50 degrees.
It was about 50 or maybe 55, 60, but it was constant year-round, which I thought was kind of lovely. Like, they always knew what they were wearing to work, you know? Well, and it would never rain, and they liked the weather conditions. They did. They said that was a plus, definitely a plus.
It gets warmer as you get further down. Gold mining is probably much, much further down mostly, yeah.
Yeah,
it
again,
must be.
Depending on the formations and whatnot. But anyway, Tom, thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
It's fascinating.
Here's an email from Eric in Boise, Idaho. As a former underground hard rock miner in the Frank Church Wilderness, I can attest to the fraternity of miners, the extreme dangers faced by the underground professionals, and the intense mutual trust among co-workers. There's no room for error and no tolerance for those who don't live by the miner's code. As dangerous as hard rock mining can be, coal mines present many more opportunities for disaster. Like the song says, it's dark as a dungeon, damp as the dew, where the danger is double and the pleasures are few. My thoughts are with the miners in Utah and their families.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. And that camaraderie, that spirit that a tight-knit group of people who work together doing specialized work, dangerous work, that really seemed to come through in your story.
Oh, and it was very much a part of the. They're so dependent on each other, moment by moment. You know, the reason that they're not having accidents is because the guy behind them is doing his job the right way, and following exactly the procedures that need to be followed. And if he doesn't, it's a problem for everyone. So that very much was, I think, a lot of the source of the brotherhood, which was, you know, let's just do this all right so we make it out of here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit. I can liken it a bit to the combat soldiers, that sort of sense of we're in this kind of terrible situation, and if we get out of here alive, it's going to be good.
Let's see if we can get Shireen on the line. Shireen's with us from Wisconsin.
Yes. My brother worked in lead mines from the time he was 17. He worked underground in D.C. for the subway. He worked in Alaska for hydroelectric plants. He couldn't wait to get to work every day.
Hmm.
It's a different kind of feeling, he said, that he just loved it. He would be there early just to see what was going on. And he finally, he had a lot of injuries. He was in California when they did a hydroelectric plant and they got caved in. He's been in a lot of cave-ins. He's lost a finger. He's broken all the bones so that he couldn't use either arm at the same time. And he could not wait to get well and go back again.
We know about claustrophobia, Jean, but I guess this is claustrophilia.
But he loved it.
I understand that. I mean, some of the guys I talked to, there was more of a, what I heard was more of a love-hate. As much as they hated it, they also loved it. And as much as they wanted to get out of there, they said, you know what, it sort of sticks to you a little bit, you know? You want to go back. You want to go back. And I even experienced a bit of that.
Yeah, at the end of your piece, you got a little addicted to this.
I did, and I still can't answer that. I was finished my research after, and, you know, come on, 4 months? How long do you need to understand
technology? That's what your
editor
was saying, yeah.
Yeah, everybody was. My mother was. And I just kept going back. I felt I needed something else. And finally, even the coal miners were saying, you know what, we're really sick of babysitting you. Can you get out of here? I'm like, all right, I'll leave. But I don't know. I like it here. Maybe it's because you've survived it a little bit. You know, you feel like, well, I can do this. Or there's something, you know, you really are away from the world. You don't have a phone down there. You don't have a water fountain. You don't have a radio. You don't have anything.
Well, my brother was a dynamiter, and he even lost fingers and things. And the work was so intense that they would pull him off the job to tell him he had cut off a finger, and he didn't even know it.
Wow.
He just loved it.
Well,
you know, maybe what you just said is the intensity. That's a good way of looking at it.
People that got hurt down there, crushed or something, he said nobody panicked, and they survived until they got him up to the top, and he said then everything went wrong. But he said there's something about being that deep that they hung in there.
Shireen, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. We're talking with Jean Marie Laskus about her article, Underworld, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get, this is Candace. Candace is on the line with us from Florida. Candace, are you there? I guess Candace is not with us. Let's see if we go instead to Cody, and Cody is calling us from Utah.
Yes, I have three generations of miners in my family. My father, my grandfather, great-grandfather, my uncle were all miners in down there in Huntington, Utah, Helper, those areas too. And the thing I've noticed is, you know, kind of like your guest was talking about, it kind of, you know, coal is in their veins. They're kind of like the fishermen who can't stand to be too far away from the sea. I myself am very claustrophobic. My mom moved me up to Salt Lake City to become a construction worker, so I didn't have to work in the coal mines. But, you know, there's just that real camaraderie, the real, like you said, the combat aspect of it, man's watching your back. And, you know, I had my grandfather had a rock fall on his head, break his neck, have it wired, but he was still back there as soon as he could possibly be. So it's just something that, you know, it's a really rich tradition here in Utah to have a miner being in the family. It's a great thing to have, and, yeah, it's dangerous. But you know what? There's certain aspects you just got to put food on the table. And sometimes it means crawling down into a hole. And, you know, my heart goes out to these miners because they're just trying to put food on the table and make sure their family is safe.
Yeah.
And
Sounds a little, Cody, as if you really wish you could have gone to work in the mines.
Oh, heck no. I'm claustrophobic. And, you know, I was trying to do anything I can to get out of the mines. It was one thing that I have great appreciation for, but it's not something I could do.
All right.
I know that as a matter of fact.
Well, the miners and their families, I hope they're in all of our thoughts. Thanks very much for the call, Cody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And interestingly, the mine that you were, the Cadiz mine that your men were working in, is about to close down. It was being played out, and they were very unsentimental about it. They'd go work somewhere else.
I know. I was more sentimental about it than they were. I'm like, oh, my, you guys, this is going to be a... closed up in a month or so. In fact, it just closed. But there's another mine right down the road that they'll be in with the same company. So, you know, to them, a coal mine is a coal mine. But I also think, too, I should say about this, like, being drawn to it, even though it's kind of so difficult. There is, like, it's a culture, you know. I mean, in Cadiz, there was a coal festival. There was the Coal Queen. There was the largest shovel in America, the Silver Spade. Is a tourist attraction. You drive up to look at that thing. It doesn't even work anymore, but you drive up to look at that thing and kind of honor it. So it's part of the culture.
Jean Marie Laskus, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jean Marie Laskus, a columnist for the Washington Post magazine, a professor in the creative writing program at the University of Pittsburgh. Her piece in GQ on coal miners is titled Underworld. She joined us from WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Coming up, a Republican candidate with a funny name. No, not Mitt. It's Fred. And a little later, we'll talk about the muse that hit Thomas Edison, apparently at 60 miles an hour. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.